previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
Everyone has a theory.
What if Mara was picked up by locals and then OD'd at a party?
I think Mara was having an affair.
Didn't a girl the same age disappear near there? Her name was Brianna Maitland, right?
Is this the work of a serial killer?
Is the disappearance of Mara Murray a crime? Probably not, but the new limited series dissecting the case is on All Crime All the Time Network Oxygen. And Lord knows most of the coverage of the case to date is misdemeanor, self-indulgent flatulence at best, so Stephanie Green and I are prepared to make an example of this defendant. Later, the Moons Over Miami of 48 Hours episode naming conventions is actually hiding a pretty interesting case, as our cold case section tackles Jake Nolan and his creepy cousin. Hide your sledgehammers, folks. It's episode 26 of The Blotter Presents. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, the previously.tv take on small screen true crime. I'm your desk sergeant, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm here with returning and inaugural guest, Stephanie Green. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, Sarah.
Folks, we'll be discussing the disappearance of Mara Murray. And when I found out that this was going to be a thing, I practically knocked myself over to email Stephanie and inform her that she was going to be on this episode. I didn't care if I had to come to her house. Like, oh, I'm having surgery that day. I don't care. I don't care if you're performing surgery that day. It can wait. We have to discuss this.
Yes.
So, yeah, I have a feeling this is going to be one of the longer and rantier The Blotter Presents is in pod history. So let's get to it with our most wanted section. Okay, The Disappearance of Mara Murray airs on Saturdays at 7 on Oxygen. Vote of no confidence department, I guess. It does air again at 9, but come on, Saturday. In case you guys aren't familiar with the case, here's the synopsis. On February 9th, 2004, Mara Murray wrecked her car in a snowbank outside Haverhill, New Hampshire, then seemingly walked away from the crash site and out of her own life. Her vanishing has obsessed amateur sleuths ever since. Their obsession has obsessed me and Counselor Green. If by obsessed, you mean annoyed to the tune of 17 emails back and forth every time Lance and Tim drop a new crapisode of their podcast. So obviously, when I got an email from Oxygen PR about this series, we had to do it and start preparing for it immediately. And it's not good. Like, it's really, it's just not good. Before I get into, before I play the troika of clips that is a formal objection to the writing, Stephanie, do you have anything that you'd like to say as a lead up?
No, I mean, from the second the show started, I was bracing myself for Tim and Lance impact, and it delivered quite quickly, and it was exactly what I expected it would be. But we can talk about that in a bit.
Yeah.
Why don't you just play the clip and we'll
it's a lot. I will also add, you should follow us on our social media, which is Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter, because I will be posting some screenshots from the episode, including the one where I saw that Lance and Tim were consulting producers on the project. Because of course they are, but our main entree into the case in this case is, I guess, investigative radio journalist Maggie Freeling. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to drag her too hard, but I'm going to drag her some. Let's start with this troika of clips I mentioned. Here's clip two.
Her life seemed to be poised for success. And then she was gone.
Her life seemed to be poised for success. It's not how we talk. And also, it totally wasn't. Her life was crumbling, as they make a point of saying in episode two. Here's clip three.
Maura's story is one of the most prominent missing persons cases of the social media age. She went missing the same week Facebook launched. And in the social media climate we now live in, everyone broadcasts their ideas.
The social media climate? I don't understand what that means. I also don't understand. And like, I'm not a big fan of the millennial generalizations, but who does she think, like, this is the most sort of millennial attracting Reddit herring case of them all. But then she's explaining this to the viewers who I just don't think that your average 55-year-old Oxygen viewer is watching this unless she already knows about the case. Would you agree?
I'm not sure. So I'm sure we'll discuss this later, but there's already another TV property about this case, and that's the or is it the ID version? What's the Disappeared? I don't even know what.
Oh, yeah. That was Disappeared. On. I think, and we'll have this in the show notes, but ID. I did a showdown between the Disappeared episode and the, I think, Dateline episode.
Was a Dateline on it?
Which, one of them was about her and the aforementioned Brianna Maitland, who I think they concluded that they weren't related because, of course, they're not related because correlation is not causation, which is not something that these shows tend to acknowledge. But yeah, so we'll link that in the show notes. But there was a Disappeared, I'm going to say 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Yeah, well, so they're rerunning that now on ID. I'm not sure why this case is suddenly hot again. But I came home the other night. My mom was at my house babysitting my kids, and then she had ID on and the Disappeared episode was on. So, and my mom had never heard of the case before. So I'm wondering if like this is just kind of floating out in the atmosphere and people will start watching it just because it seems interesting, even if they are not millennial, Redditors. I think it might be attracting a new audience now that
could
it's
be
off the internet and onto the TV. So I'm not sure she's just trying to like explain to the old people that now we have social media. Remember in 2004, we didn't, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem necessary to explain that to anyone.
Yeah. That,
you know, now we share things. Back then we didn't, you know, and
and especially, and you'll also see this on Twitter, like her look is a lot. There's
the cat eye.
There's one hats. Skype conversation she's having with James Renner where she's wearing like the knit hat with the brim and the braids. And she's sleeved up like down to her fingertips. And there's just something about these like prison quality hand tats. Like, I don't know her life. Maybe they are actually from lockup, but they aren't. Whatever.
Tells me they're not.
Yeah. I don't think so. But let's run clip four.
She's not the best ambassador to, you know, explain anything to anyone, really, but especially to like you said, your middle-aged female Oxygen viewer.
I said I wasn't going to drag her, and now I've done it to the extent that I'm going to. Like, I will give her credit that she saw that this property should be a limited series. Like, she identified the climate in terms of true crime coverage, and she saw her shot and she took it. That's A. B, I have some goofy tattoos from college. You can't actually see them. But look, we all made mistakes when we were in our 20s. And like, good for her. She saw her shot and took it. And not all of the like production crap is on her. But some of it is. And she should have been subjected to more rewrites. Like, it's one thing when Joe Berlinger is like, you know, waxing purple in his voiceover. He made the Paradise Lost trilogy and he earned it. She's like 14. Maybe, yeah. Maybe I'm just jealous. But some of this writing is bad, and let's just wrap that up in clip four.
They weren't sure if this was a real tip or something made up by an online troll. But they had planned to check it out just in case, until the ugly side of the web became a frightening reality.
Yeah. That's just a word casserole that tastes bad is A. B, they're talking about the time that Lance and Tim were apparently, like, threatened before they went to Lincoln, New Hampshire.
Yeah, threatened with, like, a very, very veiled threat, I must say. I remember it was, like, they got, like, an email that referred to, like, a penny, and then they're, yes. Lincoln's on the penny. Oh, no, they're going to Lincoln, you know, like, it was a very veiled threat, and I don't actually think it was a threat.
Distinctly remember listening to this episode. I was on Cape Cod. I was taking a walk and I just had it in my earbuds and had to like stop by the side of the road, open my little notes app and make a list of things to email you when I got back to the house, starting with, I don't get it. Like, what's the actual problem? Like, did someone put a dead rat through their mail slot? No, then I'm not really understanding the drama.
Yeah. Well, Tim and Lance are very good at casting themselves as the, you know, harassed heroes of this whole story. They square themselves right in the middle. And all the, you know, they love being victims, but also like persecuted heroes, I think is how they think of themselves. And we've talked about this before, and I've reviewed this podcast, the Missing Maura Murray podcast for The Blotter, and reviewed it negatively because they're such doofuses.
They really are. We actually had, you've mentioned it on a couple of pieces on The Blotter, which is different from the podcast. It's the-blotter.com. Right. Those will also be in our show notes, but I think some guy that they were trying to, or some guy who had been a guest, and they sort of like pressed him on his assertions, which are sort of the same as our conclusions, which are that she got in this wreck. She was probably drunk. She wandered off because she was freaking out and or may have hit her head and probably died of exposure in the woods, which are dark and deep up there.
Yep.
And he posted a comment on The Blotter that was like, thank you for writing this. Lance in particular is an asshole, and they were mean to me. And I was like, why?
I didn't even see that comment. That's really funny.
Yeah, I totally forgot about it. And then I was researching yesterday and came across it and was delighted by it all over again. That he was just so over it and disgusted by them. But they, of course, figure heavily in this, I think, as consultants. And, you know, Maggie may or may not actually feel this way. I think she probably does, but she's at least doing a good job of acting like they're the senseis experts of the case.
Well, should we play that next clip, which is
sure
relevant to
My first stop is to the suburbs of Boston to meet a pair of wildly popular true crime podcasters.
The Missing Maura Murray podcast has had over 8 million downloads since July of 2015.
Tim Polleri and Lance Reinstierna have been exploring Maura's case for 2 years and recorded over 40 episodes.
Yep. I mean, those are their qualifications. They've recorded 40 episodes of a podcast. Note that she doesn't, like, you aren't able to say any more than that about Tim and Lance. They're just like Budinskis who won't let it go, but don't actually uncover any new information or help anyone, you know, move forward with the case. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And they don't have access to the family. And I will give Maggie and the disappearance of Maura Murray credit that they do. She did get to sit down with Fred.
Yep.
Which, like, Lance and Tim's whole thing, if I recall correctly, it's, I forget when I bailed. I think it was
a while ago.
Yeah, it's been a while. I think you still only had one kid, so we're going back a minute yeah. with that. But yeah, I their whole thing was always like that. Fred was like, they were the Ahab to Fred's white whale, and were just sort of like, well, he's never going to talk to anyone, and it's like, well, I think actually the family just doesn't want to talk to you, nabobs, because yeah. you're not doing anything, like you're not helping.
And also they immediately, and we can get to this, but they immediately brought James Renner onto their podcast, and he's like, you know, not he hasn't gotten himself into the family's good graces because he's implied all sorts of terrible things about the family. So they don't like James Renner. So when Tim and Lance affiliated themselves with Renner, the family was like, well, we're done with you. If we ever, you know, we're not going to give you a chance, even if we were considering it before.
Yeah, our show notes are going to be gloriously long this week, and we'll include not only the great Michelle Dean's review of Renner's book about this case, but also a piece about Renner suing whatever Cleveland Plain Dealer Weekly magazine spinoff fired him for wanting to publish slanderous material. I'm not exactly sure what the issue was, but he is a handful, and
he's a piece of work.
Is he one of the ones who's like, Fred was bad touching Maura and possibly her sisters?
So I think he might have backed off of that because he didn't mention it in this, but I seem to recall that being a theory that was aired on Tim and Lance's podcast, and they have only had a handful of guests. So it was either Renner who said that, or it was the, I'm putting huge air quotes around this, like, psychologist who said that Maura was a psychopath.
Oh God, that guy. I mean, I didn't hate that theory, actually, just
was it the psychologist who said she wasn't? Now it's been so long, I can't remember. Was it Tim and Lance who were saying she was a psychopath? And then the psychologist was like, no, she's not. Now I can't remember.
Yeah. And then
totally mischaracterizing what he said.
Based on the inventory of her car, I believe they reversed themselves and they were like, she's just a normal girl. And I was like,
she had Twizzlers in her car.
Yes. Yeah. Because she had Twizzlers and Diet Coke. I'm like, yeah, but the Diet Coke bottle was filled with Franzia. Like, not that I haven't gone there, but I wasn't driving and I'm very much still here.
Yeah.
To everyone's delight, I am sure. But I remember you and I discussing that. I think that psychologist did say that it was possible just based on the fact that she was exhibiting some behaviors, like acting out behaviors consistent with like abuse or sexual PTSD, abuse. But they could also just be someone being a dumb 18-year-old, which it's difficult to conclude anything.
Well, they didn't go there in this episode, obviously, because they talked to Fred, and you're not about to like accuse some guy of A, there's zero evidence, B, you can't accuse someone of sexually assaulting his kid and then expect him to sit down with you.
Well, yeah, like you do kind of have to choose. Like if he declines to even dignify that, then there you are. But
right. But before we get into that, I just wanted to go back to Tim and Lance for a second.
Oh, please.
So had you ever seen them
spend
before,
all the time
Sarah?
You like.
Did you know what they looked like?
No.
So I had a picture of them in my mind, and in my mind, they both looked like how Tim actually looks. Like Tim looks exactly as I expected. Tim's face and voice is the essence of both Tim and Lance, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But then Lance was like way cuter than I thought he'd be.
Yeah, I thought I thought Lance would have no chin. I thought Lance would be like
fox. I was surprised.
Yeah. But then the minute they open,
I still hate him, but
the minute he opens his mouth, it's like, oh,
right. Yeah.
I was dismayed to see that we use the same microphones. I mean, I'm sure everyone uses these microphones for podcasting, but I had to really stop myself from, you know, drop kicking my Yeti out the office window.
Oh, Lord.
I'm hateful. Yeah, I'm actually going to play our next clip out of order because it goes to the participation of the family. So I'm just going to jump ahead to clip 7 and then we can get back into dragging Renner. So
sure.
Here's this. Maggie has gotten an interview with Maura's younger brother, Kurt. Is that his name?
Yeah, Kurt.
And which I don't think I remembered that he existed. Again, I've been sort of out of the loop on this case for a while because it basically isn't a case. But anyway, here's...
I've never heard of Kurt either.
And I think she has another brother as well. But in any case, here is her non-insight in VO about this interview.
If their father was responsible in any way, Kurt would certainly have some insight.
I guess, but like he's going to tell you if Fred's a rapey monster. Come on.
Well, maybe we should play the next clip, too, because it's kind of the same idea. They get annoyed because they can't pin down. So first they talk to Julie, which is one of Maura's sisters. I guess that was the sister who was at West Point with her. And they ran cross country and track together and stuff. And then. But the sister she was really tight with was Kathleen. And Kathleen was the one who I guess Maura had an upsetting conversation with the day before she disappeared or something. I don't remember the exact timing. So Kathleen, they think, will be able to give them a lot of insight into Maura's disappearance. Again, why would she tell them anything? But they can't pin Kathleen down and they keep calling her and she doesn't want to talk to them. And they get kind of, you know, self-righteous about it. And that was what I wanted to play for the next clip.
It's hard to verify stories and eliminate theories when those close to Maura won't open up. I don't want to just take James Renner's word, but I'm hitting a frustrating roadblock, especially with Kathleen and Bill. If people won't talk, maybe the evidence will tell us something.
Spoiler, it won't, but there's a couple of things I want to get into here related to that clip. First is what ends up happening in episode 2 with Kathleen, and the second is the location of Bill in all of this. But before we address any of those, right. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about this clip?
Well, just why would they talk to you? It's like, it's really hard for us to verify things if you won't talk to us. It's like they don't care what you think, you know? Like, why should Maura's family care? I mean, yes, they're going to care because you might put out a theory that they don't agree with on your TV show. But that's already happened. I mean, they've been dealing with people's crazy conspiracy theories for, you know, 13 years now or however long Maura has been gone. So, you know, what urgency would they feel to speak to you to clear up the record, you rando?
Well,
you know what
I
mean?
Like, I can see them being like, okay, even if they think that we're criminally involved, if that gets the police and or the FBI to really throw everything at trying to find Maura or her remains, then we'll take the hit. But it's been 13 years, so clearly that's not a strategy that's going to work. And it just makes your family look, I mean, and also, like, families are fucked up, all of them. It's, you know?
Yeah.
So the things they think they're uncovering that are so scandalous, like, especially the shoplifting, like, all right, it's interesting that she was at West Point, that this occurred then, I guess. But again, oversubscribing every little thing about her life, like, I understand that's the job of the show. But, I mean... Well, whatever. All right. So let's talk about Kathleen. At the sort of towards the end of episode 2, they introduce this like former. Oh, Maggie is working with a guy, Art Roderick, who is a former marshal. And he's pretty great, although he doesn't need to be sitting like in a diner in New Hampshire with his little marshal star on his lapel. That's a little much. Like, there aren't more than one marshal in the show. We'll know who it is. But then they get Evie, it's not Pompadour. I'm so sorry, Evie. I think she used to be I don't actually know what she used to be, but she's like an expert at like interrogations and sort of getting in someone's ear who's in the interrogation room and reading body language. It's nothing anyone who didn't watch the series run of CSI couldn't do, but she's fairly likable, and they're analyzing Kathleen's, like, as they're sitting on these hotel beds, her and Maggie, and Maggie's trying to like press her a little bit on what she does and doesn't remember about that phone call, which again was 13 years ago. And Kathleen has had some struggles with substance abuse. What did you, what did you think of their bringing in like a, whatever, body language expert to deal with Kathleen?
It actually made me a little uncomfortable just because Kathleen doesn't have to talk to them, right? And it felt kind of shitty to see her sitting in this hotel room and behind a two-way mirror, this body language expert and Art are whispering things in Maggie's ear, and Maggie kind of was trying to take this sort of like assertive tone with Kathleen to get her to like admit what she knew. And Kathleen seems like a mess. I mean, she seems like she's not, something's off with her, right? Brain chemistry speaking. And it just felt like they were sort of picking on a lady who was kind of already down. And I don't think Kathleen's going to like break down and admit, I know where Maura is. Like, no one's going to do that, right? No one is going to fess up to Maggie Freeling and her beanie, like, so it just felt kind of shitty. I don't know what you thought about
especially
it.
When she was like, Maggie asked her to just talk about Maura as a kid and like the last time she saw Maura and holidays at home, and Kathleen is just sort of spouting what any family member says to any true crime host since time immemorial, which is like, she was great. She was a lot of fun. She loved to laugh. We were having a great family dinners, laughing and joking. And behind the mirror, they're like, that's horseshit. And it's like, well, of course it's horseshit. If you've lived through one Thanksgiving with any in-law, okay, fine. But what do you expect her to say? Like, she's not going to be like, actually, I walked in on Fred grabbing her. Even if that happened, she's not going to say that.
And the family closed ranks a long time ago. They're not going to, you know, none of them are going to break.
If there's anything to break, there's, I mean, there's probably not.
Exactly.
And even if there is, it's like this individual out of all of them is the least likely to remember. And if she really was struggling with her drinking at that time, or whatever else she was struggling with, and she may have been self-medicating some other condition, who knows? She just may not really remember. Like 13 Christmases ago, I can guess where I was geographically. I don't have a specific memory, really. It was Christmas. Yeah. It was probably fine. My mother probably was a lot at some point. Like, I don't know. I was also probably drunk. I don't know what happened. It was Christmas. It just, it really did seem sad. And the extreme close-ups that they were putting on her, and like the way that her eyes were moving and just that she was fidgety. You have to wonder what Kathleen's thought process was with participating in this. I just, it was a little sad and discomforting. I agree.
I felt like they didn't, after she agreed to talk to them, which again, she did not have to do, they should have kind of treated her with a bit more respect, because whether they believe what she's saying or not, she's going to watch this now and feel like an idiot.
Yeah.
You know?
And now the family's never going to talk to anybody, which okay.
Exactly.
If that's how you want to play it.
So, I mean,
yeah, that was, and we'll see how that plays out as the series continues. As you're listening to this, that episode has not aired yet. So, but yeah, and that interview has not concluded, I believe. So we'll see how that plays out.
I think it was like a cliffhanger.
But they also spent a lot of time sort of chewing over the relationship between Maura and Bill and whether that was a catalyst and could she be pregnant and all this stuff. And had he been abusive and cheated on her? Wasn't he in like Nebraska when the shit went down?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he had an alibi. Although, again, I don't remember the details, and they didn't really get into those details on this episode.
Or in the episode following, but I distinctly remember that he was in another time zone, and there were calls from, like, I want to say Nebraska or Oklahoma. Forgive me. Please hit us in the comments or on Twitter if you remember this. I'm not going back to listen to MMM to verify this, but I'm pretty sure that as far as, like, I don't know, having any role in her disappearance or in various theories about how she crashed and then was picked up by a Confederate, he was not involved, good or bad. So, and I just didn't really understand why that wasn't cleared up. I mean, I do understand, but it's annoying.
Well, especially because they let, and they let Renner natter on about his theories and how, you know, she was pregnant with Bill's baby and she was running away from him and he was abusive. I'm like, can you say this? I mean, these allegations seem unconfirmed, and it seems irresponsible for the show to just be airing them without running through the research on them and trying to either prove or disprove, but like back them up or not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They just let Renner talk, and then they were like, okay, moving on. Like, maybe look into what he's saying and then either back it up or don't, but don't just let it sit there because that's irresponsible.
Well, we're going to have a whole shut up Renner section to close out our discussion.
Oh,
but yeah, I thought it was interesting that in episode one, Renner is kind of the, like, also the sensei of the case, and it's like conscience and hero. But then everything that Aaron, Maura's friend from school, says about, like, Renner's evidence that Maura could have been pregnant seems to have been that she was Googling the effects of booze on a fetus. And then her schoolmate was like, we are nursing students. We were in a maternity unit.
Yep.
That is dumb. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And she had birth control in her car. So, you know, why would you bring your birth control if you're pregnant?
You know? Or if you're, you know, like, if you are trying to escape your own life, but you still brought your birth control and your nursing books, that's very weird. But let's just say that going back to clip six, that the show's skepticism of Renner generally could use some burnishing.
Say what you will about him, his research and his dedication to that blog opened the case up to a lot of people. Really opened the case up to us.
True.
Like, thanks, Renner. Thanks for opening the case up to these two peaches, you know?
Yes, you can pick up your Darwin Award at the table in the back.
Yeah. Say what you will about him, as if, like, well, you can say a lot of bad stuff about him, but he did allow us to do this podcast. It's like, no, I'm tallying that in the bad category, Tim and Lance.
Well, and
sorry, guys.
The other thing about both Lance and Tim and Renner is that they sort of position their nosy know-it-allness about these cases in this meta way where they're talking about their obsession with the case and not about the case.
Yeah.
And Renner makes sure in clip nine to get that dubious bit of branding into the show.
I think everybody that's drawn to this mystery is drawn to it because of the puzzle. People come to it to try to be a hero, and they think that they're going to be smart enough to crack it. But this case, it weighs on you. You will become obsessed with this case. If you haven't already, you will.
Oh, word? Everyone wants to be a hero and solve the puzzle? Jimbo, tell us more. Well, wait, don't.
So here's why I love Art Roderick, because he's like this, despite his like sad like star that he's wearing on his jacket, he is the voice of reason here, because he comments that to Maggie, like, you know, people like to insert themselves into the center of these yeah, cases. It's like, yeah. Gentle reminder that literally everyone you have talked to so far, Renner, Tim, and Lance, they can't help themselves. They have to be in the center of it, and they have to connect themselves to it as if like their interest in it qualifies them to know anything or talk about yeah, it. You know what I mean?
Because they have devoted literally 3 hours of their lives and ours to the rag in the tailpipe, which mercifully was not mentioned, but I noticed that someone had left a rag in the car, which they went to visit in impound, that there was a rag in the tailpipe, which I'm sure someone like made sure to stick in there before they started shooting that fucking thing. I can't.
I'm really glad it wasn't mentioned. I'm sure Tim and Lance brought it up, and then someone in production cut it because it's just too much yeah. even for this show.
But then, all right, I guess we should say that Renner's operating theory at the moment, at least, is that Maura was pregnant and Bill was abusive and she didn't want anyone to know where she was. So she went, I guess, to Quebec. As one does. Sure. And is like raising Bora there, I guess. her tween child with the notorious B.I.L.L., which is not the stupidest fucking thing I ever heard, even from Renner, but it's right up there. But he makes sure to let Maggie and Art know that they have a responsibility to her privacy in our final clip.
But I would say this, that when you do find Maura, I would ask that you not tell anybody where she's at, not even the police, because it's going to end up in their report, and all that becomes public record. And Fred Murray can read it, and Bill can read it. And then Moore is not hidden anymore.
Okay, first of all, soundtrack, settle down. Second of all, Renner, you're not getting a parade for hiding her from her family. There's just something so like hero, like, I don't know, like this weird Galahad complex he has about this whole case and her specifically. And like, he's gonna get, like, she's gonna pin a star on him for saving her from the other men in her life. Like, if she did have the wherewithal to go to another country and with all this Reddit foolishness remain hidden with a kid for 12 years, like, she doesn't need your help. She's got this. And also, that's not what happened. And also, also, fuck off. He's just so, he's not even like, he's not evil. He's just like a gnat. I can't.
He's so convinced of his rightness, despite the fact that his theory doesn't make sense. Like, you can poke a million holes in it. Like, for example, Maura was at a party with all these people, or, you know, a small party. He's convinced that all those friends, it was a going away party because she had announced to all of her friends that she was going to, like, take off and leave the country. So if you're trying to escape your own life, you don't throw a freaking party and tell everyone where you're going. And if you did, those people would not keep quiet about it for 12 years. I mean, maybe some of them would, but surely someone would talk at this point.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, what I mean? When someone's like, well, the moon landing was faked. I'm like, someone would have cracked so long ago if that were true.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And I just don't.
So, I mean,
and if you have this whole like Rube Goldberg plan where someone is like caravanning with you and you're gonna fake this wreck and then get in someone else's car, first of all, you don't fake the wreck because you don't want to draw attention, even in rural New Hampshire.
Of course.
Second of all, it was like her third wreck in 2 weeks. Like, I don't Not that she couldn't have become a mastermind between the wreck of her father's car and this little fender bender, but I don't think it was that elaborate because I've lived in the world.
No.
Like, she's not alive. That's very sad for her family. But focus on... Ugh,
well,
whatever.
I think either... Did you change your... I don't know if you had like a going theory before you watched this, and if so, if this changed your theory at all.
I had forgotten that they brought the canine unit out and that they tracked her to the middle of the road and then the scent ended.
Right.
Not that canines are perfect, but when it comes to this stuff, it's pretty close, but I don't know how temperature affects that. I don't know how time affects that. I don't think the canines were brought out for a while. So I was like, okay, it is possible that she got a ride from someone and then they killed her. It's possible that she got a ride, was dropped off in a town, wandered into the woods. Like, a lot of things could have happened, but it didn't really, it didn't really change my theory, because I think she is dead and her remains are in the woods somewhere, whether it's because she wandered off or was dumped there. I'm not as sure, but I think while there may have been a like ride in the middle there somewhere that she got like hitchhiking in the middle somewhere, I think she still wandered into the woods and perished there. Under her own steam, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And
did this change anything for you?
I guess originally. Well, yeah, I guess. Well, I didn't agree with the theories that she knew. So I couldn't tell if Maggie and Art are seriously entertaining the idea that she had a Confederate who picked her up, because that would take. I mean, it just seems ridiculous on its face. That would take so much coordination in a time where cell phone or in a place where cell phone service wasn't working. And in a time where cell phones weren't as, you know, ubiquitous anyway, it would take like precise GPSing to be able to pull that off. And Renner points to the fact that Maura turned down what's his face, the bus driver, Butch Atwood. So therefore, when she got into another car, it clearly was someone she knew. I'm like, well, or maybe she just didn't want a ride from Butch Atwood because he was creepy for some reason to her. And then another car came along and maybe it was a woman. Maybe it was someone who looked less creepy and she got into the car with them. And then, like you said, anything could have happened after that. So the only way my thinking changed was that I think she probably did get into another car. And I didn't used to think that, but I don't think that it was someone she knew, and I definitely do think she's dead.
Yeah,
which I already thought.
All the sort of like flaky, semi-self-destructive behavior that she was exhibiting, I don't think if she were alive that she would have stayed away. I just like it just doesn't make
no
sense to me. But I mean, I really don't know anything, so. Yeah.
Yeah. No one does.
So that's I get that that's why cases like this stick with us and that we obsess over them. But, you know, there's just not much case here, I don't feel. And after almost 15 years, it's, you know, I understand why this show was made, but I don't think I understand how it's going to, like, how there's going to be any kind of arc or conclusions. Are you going to keep hate watching this, or are you over it?
I can't decide. I mean,
same.
The only reason I would keep watching it is to see them kind of unspool all the various theories, but because they are confusing and it's been so long since I listened to that friggin' podcast that I can't remember all of the different theories. So, I mean, that would be kind of interesting to me, but Maggie's like, shifting credulousness really does great. She believes 100% whatever person she's talking to at the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, she's like, well, now I believe Renner. And then she talks to someone else who like pokes a hole in something he said, oh, now I don't believe Renner. And that gets exhausting.
It does. And there's like kind of too many shots of her like doing her best active listening. It's just like she's
driving or going into the liquor store and buying exactly what Maura bought, because that's really going to give us a lot of insight into what happened. She goes into the liquor store, buys like boxed wine or whatever, and then puts it in her back seat and keeps driving. I'm like, what did that just do for you? How did that aid your
I know. Did that pierce the veil so that you could see Maura on the other side? I mean, that is one aspect where I have a feeling that that's like executives being like, we want the, you know, we want this arc over, I think it's 6 episodes. So you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to sort of like manipulate your own timeline of what you know and think to make this so that viewers are going on this journey with you. I don't know. Like I don't envy her position with this, certainly.
No.
Because nobody wants to watch a show that's like, honestly, one of us being like, are you fucking kidding? Over and over again to every single person they interview except for or maybe they do. I don't know. Hit us on Twitter at Blutter Presents.
Yeah, oh, maybe my God. We should get a show.
We definitely should. I don't have any knuckle tattoos, though.
Can we just go and like bully Tim and Lance? Can that be our show?
Or just stand outside their apartment and be like, no, dude. Okay. Well, so once again, Disappearance of Maura Murray airs Saturdays at 7 and 9 o'clock on Oxygen. And we hope that you will share your theories of the show and the case on our forums, previously.tv/forums. And that is all for our most wanted section. And now, speaking of mental struggles and the or mental illness struggles and the perhaps not so up to date treatment thereof, let's move along to our cold case. This is from a relatively recent episode of 48 Hours called "The Psychiatrist and the Selfie." This was deleted from our DVR without comment by my husband because he thought the title was so stupid that we were going to be super annoyed. And I was like, but it could be really hilarious. Not necessarily the word I'd use, but let me give you a quick case synopsis. This is from the Times piece on Nolan's conviction, spoiler, by James McKinley Jr. A Long Island man from a wealthy family who argued he was brainwashed to kill his cousin's former boyfriend was convicted of attempted murder after a lengthy trial that featured expert witnesses who testified about the effect of indoctrination on a weak psyche. A Manhattan jury took only 50 minutes, 50, to find the man, Jacob Nolan, 23, guilty of all charges in connection with the bludgeoning and stabbing of Michael Weiss, an Upper West Side psychiatrist, in his home office on November 12, 2012. Defense lawyers never disputed that Mr. Nolan, who had a history of mental illness, went to Mr. Weiss's apartment with a sledgehammer and a knife in a duffel bag that day. Weiss testified that Nolan tried to hit him in the head with the sledgehammer, then stabbed him 7 times before he was able to break free. But the defense argued that Nolan was not acting of his own volition. They claimed he had been programmed by Weiss's former girlfriend, Pamela Bookbinder, who was involved in a bitter custody battle with Mr. Weiss over their young son. Bookbinder has not been charged to date, although apparently Weiss sued her for wrongful not quite death or something. And I did a lot of Googling, but I wasn't able, I wasn't able to see if how that had been, that case had been disposed or if it had. It is on LexisNexis, but I am not an attorney and could not get to it. Stephanie, you brought us this case. Why?
Well, so I had to come up with a cold case. So something that had already happened. And I was just kind of going through my mental bank of interesting true crime that I'd seen on TV. And this one was the first thing that popped into mind. I'm like, oh, remember that one where the kid, well, he wasn't a kid. He was an adult man. The young man stabbed that guy and sledgehammered him a bunch of times because his weird cousin / psychiatrist / lover maybe convinced him to do it. slash boss.
Yeah.
And I just remember the case being super weird, and unsatisfyingly resolved. So that's why I wanted to revisit it.
Yeah, that it's a terrible title. I mean, my husband was not wrong.
I didn't remember it was called that, to be fair. I don't even look at the title. Yeah,
you'll be able to see, again, on our social media, the selfie in question. Keeping in mind that he took this selfie like Weiss had not been killed and, in fact, had fought back and stabbed Nolan a couple times pretty seriously. And while he's, like, waiting, I guess, for 911 to show up, he took a selfie of...
That's actually clip 14.
Why don't we just jump ahead?
As he sat on the floor bleeding, Jake lifted his cell phone and took that selfie.
Why did you take a selfie?
You know, we were sitting right next to each other, and I was reporting back to Pamela, like, what do I do next?
Yeah, so Pamela is his cousin who I believe Jake had been struggling with mental illness, and Pamela also was, in a different way, in my opinion, not a doctor. So the family sort of like jointly decided that Jake should live with her and her then 4-year-old Calder and be like, have like therapy sessions a few times a week with Pamela, but also be a manny for Calder. Cause what?
Can you hear me shaking my head in disgust? It's the dumbest. It's as a parent for this lady to bring her mentally ill, seriously mentally ill cousin into her home to take care of her child while giving him ethically questionable therapy sessions. I mean, the whole thing is just a huge mess.
I don't know. Like, I was not a big fan. I didn't call for any clips from this, but based on the ones you called for, I have a feeling we agree on their, let's just say, murky failure to distinguish amongst various kinds of serious mental illness. Why don't I play clip 11 and then you can talk about what you called for that one.
Bipolar disorder is a severe and chronic mental illness that's characterized by severe mood swings.
Psychiatrist Dr. Sasha Bardet has evaluated Jake for the defense.
Swings that go from deep, dark, suicidal depressions to periods of incredible elation, grandiose ideas, poor judgment. He's a mess. He's such a prisoner of his own mind that he can't get anywhere in life.
This from a psychiatrist. That's great. I mean, look, I do not suffer from bipolar, either one. And I, again, am not a doctor. But the diagnosis, like, the show just keeps sort of conflating it with paranoid schizophrenia and the delusions that would pertain there. And like, I know a ton of people with bipolar and they've gotten many places in life. Like maybe in the 70s when they didn't know how to medicate this shit, but like, what are you talking about?
And also, even if it were true that someone with bipolar disorder couldn't, you know, succeed in a job or something like that, which I don't think is necessarily true, that's a far cry from agreeing to murder someone on behalf of your therapist. You know, that's a whole other.
That's the thing, because the prosecution seems to be arguing, or like Bookbinder also seems to be claiming, like, no, he came up with this all on his own and he's deluded. Like, well, maybe that's true, but I'm not sure that level of delusion has anything to do with bipolar disorder.
Right. Well, he claims he was psychotic during the actual episode, which I think for legal reasons, you kind of have to say, because they were arguing diminished capacity. So I think they had to say that he was psychotic. He wasn't in his right mind, but that's a different,
that's like
I mean, with,
that's also I'm like the sort of monotonous, like that's, you know, the legal standard of insane versus the clinical standard of insane. And neither of them would seem to be pertinent here necessarily. But if he was using that affirmative defense, then.
So it's like you said, it's murky, but I came away from it thinking clearly this is a guy with some sort of mental illness that's not being treated effectively. Although they did say he tried all these medications and he was using drugs and drinking at the same time. So like maybe stop drinking and doing drugs while you're on your trying to treat your out of control bipolar disorder, is point A. And then point B is, yeah, even if he did have all this mental illness and had a weird and unethical relationship with his therapist slash cousin slash mommy figure slash lover, whatever she was, I don't think that 100% accounts for his willingness to murder a dude like in cold blood and plan it.
Yeah,
you know, and I don't know how long with bipolar disorder. Like the psychiatrist who had the clip from said, there are these swings. And I understand that manic periods where you're deluded and excitable and whatever can last for a long time. But this was planned over months and months, right? Or weeks and weeks at the very least. So during that period, he's not going to be in this manic, deluded state the whole time. He would have had the opportunity to question this plan as his moods
right
back and forth.
But then I also think,
right,
then I also feel like that's where that would speak more to the involvement of the shrink slash mommy figure, because first of all, we do see her buying a sledgehammer, which what do you need that for in a Manhattan apartment? I mean, yeah. Also, what do you even need that for a murder? Like, come on, like bring two knives. Like, that's just really inefficient and weird. But
yeah,
it feels to me like she'd known him for a long time. She understood enough about his condition that she could kind of boomerang it for her own purposes. I'm not saying he's not responsible, but I do think it's possible, especially for like a guy in late adolescence who like it looks to him like his disease being managed by a caring family member. I don't know. I mean, should we play clip 12? Is that related to what we're talking about?
Well, that was just about their plan for Jake to take care of Pamela's child in spite of his crippling mental illness. So we don't need to play that one. Maybe the next one.
There's a photograph of the three of you in bed, basically in your underwear. What should we take from that picture?
I guess that just goes to show you the level of comfort that I really felt there. It was not unusual in the morning for her to invite me into bed with Calder and I and to share that familiar moment, you know, really feel like a family together.
I mean,
yeah.
I guess it just depends. Like, if you think that he's full of shit, then you could argue that he wasn't invited or that they were like just making a sheet for it and it was the middle of the day and whatever. Like, I'm sure this could be spun from either direction, but I'm not inclined. Yeah. Like, he's still responsible. It's terrible what he did. And his parents, who are cast as also sort of victims in all of this, like, should have known better than to agree to this situation. But I don't know. Like, I just feel like maybe he and his cousin were fucking. And you can make
late teenage boys
that you're fucking do a lot of things. No offense, slay teenage boys, but
yeah,
little head can be reasoned with sometimes.
Well,
a lot more easily than big head. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is just so sordid, no matter what happened. But
It's super gross. I don't understand how she has not been charged. I don't understand. She was the one who bought the sledgehammer. There's like a million text messages between them checking in, and they're clearly planning something. You know, like it's what motive would he have to attack this guy who she was in a bitter custody battle with if she hadn't suggested it? You know, I know it's all circumstantial, but like she was at the very least some sort of.
And there's also evidence that she is not able to control her impulses when it comes to her ex. Like they had both been. Like they had both been sort of put in bracelets for attacking the other one, but she went after Weiss with broken glass.
Mm-hmm.
She's not.
Yeah, she seemed like a nut too in that video they had of her from Jake's bar mitzvah. She just, there's something weird about her affect where I'm like, I wouldn't trust this lady with the 10-foot pole.
Yeah, it was weird. Dan and I, my husband, were watching Get Out last night, and it, like, just the like weird affect of Catherine Keener's character that Dad's like, well, who would, like, what psychiatrist would act like this? And I'm like, you watch a lot of true crime, honey. You know, so some of them are creeps, and you know, Exhibit A, the psychiatrist and the selfie.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Didn't we delete that? Yeah. So yeah, I was sort of like, I was sucked into this. I thought, first of all, I think Peter Van Sant is like the most unappreciated 48 Hours correspondent. I dig his deep skepticism. I mean, all the love for Aaron, of course, but I think Van Sant is coming on as my favorite. Yeah. But
my girl Maureen.
Yeah. I was like, I just kept going back and forth. But then I always came back to, how was Bookbinder not charged? But
I know.
Yeah. If any of you people who are better at the Google than I am have any intel about how Weiss v. Nolan, I think Weiss just sued everybody, but basically sued for Bookbinder for whatever the equivalent of wrongful death without a death is. And then he did get full custody of Calder and they split town. So at least that happened. And she's not even allowed any contact with Calder until like 2021, which works. But yeah, this was a good one. Good choice. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm glad you liked it.
All right. I am going to play clip 12 just because I wanted to get in one more comment about its commentary.
Jake would live part-time with Pamela in her Manhattan apartment.
Okay.
She would give him therapy sessions and monitor his meds. In return, she proposed he help take care of her then 4-year-old son, Calder, in spite of Jake's mental illness.
Yeah. Here again, I'm just not crazy about the implication that people with mental illness can't have quote unquote normal lives, can't care for kids, can't have jobs. Like some of them can't. If you can't work out the cocktail of medication, it takes a while sometimes, but 48 Hours' attitude about this just seemed kind of dated to me.
Yeah, I guess maybe they were relying on the earlier context they had given that his bipolar disorder was not being medicated correctly, and he was still struggling with.
Well, you know, and was symptoms. Not struggling to light up.
So maybe
bongs, which they showed that one picture, and then like did the like dramatic close up on it, like he's in college.
Well, that alone. I mean, why would you want someone to take care of your 4-year-old who is like smoking doobies and like, or not doobies, bongs, whatever, smoking the marijuana and also drinking and also has the bipolar on top of it. I mean, you know, if someone has their bipolar well under control and it's medicated appropriately, then you could consider, okay, do I trust this person to take care of my child? But I think,
yeah, it just seems like I wouldn't,
said, but I
you know,
think that they
I wouldn't
were,
put this guy in charge of my niece who's that age, but it's like, you know, I didn't love the phrasing. On the other hand, making child care a part of someone's like work to wellness
therapy
program that is not like that it's not a program. It's that you want free childcare and some cousin D. Okay. Yeah, sorry.
Ugh. Also, did we ever really like establish the cousin, the precise cousin relationship? Because they never explain. She's a lot older than him. Like, is she actually a first cousin or is she a cousin?
Yeah, you know, no, like I felt like it was related. Maybe her, because she did look a little like one of the parents. I think she's probably one of the parents' cousins. But like a cousin can be.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a first cousin once.
Like, and cousins can be sort of real distant and it's not that weird, but this was just weird and wrong on every possible level.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good talk. Stephanie, where else can listeners find you?
I am on Twitter at Eteffi, E-T-E-F-F-I, and I write for previously.tv, but I'm kind of on hiatus until January when The Bachelor comes back and Wine and Roses, our Bachelor podcast, will kick back up again. So until then, you can find me on my blog, which is Stephanie.
And you'll definitely also be able to see Stephanie's many negative thoughts about missing Maura Murray in our show notes, which will be a garden of delights. Coming up on future episodes of The Blotter, Alan Sepinwall on Netflix's Mindhunters. Someone surely will join me to talk about The 11 on A&E. And in November, Kat McPhee as Catherine Durst. And also some Truman Capote, because why not? I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting. I am on Twitter at Tomato Nation. This fine podcast is on Twitter at Blotter Presents, and that's also where you can find us on Facebook. Please tweet at us, visit us on the forums at previously.tv/forums, and we will talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.